We can all cry. My name is Cheryl Bradley, and I am a grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship called Al-Anon.
Hi, Cheryl.
See this corsage going. Let me start by thanking the committee. Miles, too, took me by surprise. But I've had such a wonderful time this weekend, and I don't know that I've met a warmer bunch of people than you people. And again, makes me very grateful for our fellowships. I had a great fruit basket in my room, and I consumed about half of it last night, so if any other speakers have any left over, you know, I'm in room 206. I've been very lucky to have Shauna as a hostess, and her husband Scott as well. They've both been very gracious. I don't know if Scott's had much experience with having gracious in the same sentence with his name or not, but... I've had such a wonderful time. You know, I'm very grateful to be here and to be asked. It's a real honor for me. I am not an authority on Al-Anon. The opinions that I express here today are my own, and I shake really bad for about 5 minutes. So if you can bear with that, it will go away. The tremors go away. Something else that I like to share when I talk from a podium is that. What makes me a member of Al-Anon is not that I'm married to an alcoholic. What makes me a member of Al-Anon is that I attend meetings, I have a sponsor, and I try to work the 12 steps and the 12 traditions of my life every day. Some days I'm better than others. I consume great amounts of water while I talk. That too will get better. The celebration of sobriety, I feel very, very fortunate that we have sobriety in our house today. And I don't know if that makes it easier for me to work my program or not. I think it probably does. But sobriety is certainly a celebration in our home. This past March, my husband celebrated 9 years of sobriety, and I can't begin to tell you how that makes me feel. It's the most wonderful thing in the entire world. The second most wonderful thing is being here. And being with people like you. To tell you a little bit about myself, I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, in a little town called Belton, which is just south of the city. I, like I've heard so many times from podiums, I never felt like I belonged. I always thought that I was adopted. I spent endless hours looking through the file box in my parents' bedroom and looking for the adoption papers. I have a brother who is 2 years older than myself, and I always believed that my folks liked him better. Part of this was because they had all these photo albums of all these pictures of Mike, and I thought only a few of me, plus all the ones that I was in. Mike was in too. So I spent a lot of time being a very jealous child. I spent a little time being a very jealous adult too. What I found out about 25 years later when I shared this with my mom was it was because my dad was in Korea in the Korean War when my brother was born, and there for the next 16 months, my dad never even saw him until he was, you know, a year and a half old, and that's why there were so many pictures of Mike. You know, I just wished I could have asked a little sooner. In my family, we didn't express love to each other. This was something that you were supposed to know. You just know that you're loved. If you're a child, you're loved, and you just know that. And I guess the same for if you're an adult, but... I was a child and I was an adult who needed to hear those words and didn't. I always felt that something was missing. I just never felt like I belonged. I never felt like anybody needed me. We didn't tell each other we loved each other. What we did do was every night before we went to bed, my folks were usually laying on the couch watching television, and we would walk out to kiss them goodnight. And so I'd been down to get my mom a kiss goodnight, and she'd yank her mouth over like this, so I could kiss her on the cheek, so I wouldn't kiss her on the mouth. And I took that very personally, and I took that very personally for a great many years after that. I took that I wasn't good enough for her to allow me to kiss her, that there was something wrong with me. About 9 years ago, when I started exploring some of the stuff, I was at my grandma's, and I went to kiss her goodbye as I was leaving her house from visiting, and I bent down to kiss her, and she goes like this and yanks her mouth over so I wouldn't kiss her on the mouth. And that's when I got to see why my mom did that. You know, that's what she was taught to do. What I did to correct this and to make me feel good was one time I was visiting my mom's house in Kansas City, and I was getting ready to go to bed, and she yanked her mouth over, and I took her face between my hands, and I kissed her square on the mouth. And she just kind of laughed, you know, like she didn't quite know why I did that. And so I told her why, and she said, "That's what Grandma does. Grandma says you're not supposed to kiss on the mouth." And I said, "Well, can we change that?" And she said, "Yeah, let's do." And we have very deliberate kisses on the mouth today, and it's real good. When in growing up, there was not any alcoholics in my family. And I've stood from podiums many times and made that statement. In the last several years, I've found out that there are many alcoholics in my family. The earliest memory that I have of my granddad on my mom's father was him covered with blood, smelling badly of liquor, and chicken feathers stuck in the blood all over him. He was a truck driver and carried chickens, and it crashed because he was drunk. And so that was just Grandpa. You know, Grandpa was kind of mean. He was kind of nasty. He wasn't a very pleasant person to be around, and he didn't appear to like us kids at all. And so I stayed away from Grandpa at all costs. Grandpa drank in the barn, though. Grandma wouldn't allow it in the house. So I never saw him drink. I just smelled him. You know, you could just smell him coming. I had a great uncle who wasn't an alcoholic either. My great uncle, when he would come over, if adults weren't at my grandma's house, we were told to hide in the closet. And so we'd hide up in the shoeboxes at the top of the closet so this great uncle wouldn't find us. So if mom was at the store, they were lived out in the country, we would hear a car coming up the big hill, and my brother and I and my mom's youngest sister would head to the closet and would hide. I don't know how many times we did that. It seems like we did it a lot of times, but we may have only did it a couple times. The thing was about that is that we were probably hiding from the mailman. You know, we never knew who was coming up the hill, but they had instilled a fear in us. You know, he drank, he was bad, you hide, and so we did. However, he wasn't an alcoholic. No one back in those days were alcoholics, much less recovering alcoholics. They were called alkies. And that's what I thought people that drank too much were. But in order to be an alky, you had to drink every day. You had to not bathe and be raggedy. And most lived under bridges, I think. And none were related to me. But when I was, my dad drank, and it was an occasion, kind of. I couldn't wait until I was old enough to drink, actually. My dad used to open a bottle of 7-Up and let my brother and I drink it halfway down, then he'd fill the rest of the way up with vodka as we'd drive down the road. The only time that I remember in our household of having any arguments or fights or anything was when my dad was drinking. I didn't realize until a few years ago that my dad was probably an alcoholic. My dad died when I was 12 years old in a car accident. What happened was he was killed by a drunk driver. And no one can tell me so, and they didn't do the alcohol test back then, but my dad was probably drunk. And that was the beginning of, for me, of being very powerful. When I found out that my folks had been in this accident, I was down at my grandparents visiting. I felt guilty about that. I wasn't there. I couldn't have stopped it. If I'd been there, they wouldn't have gone out. When I was told that the accident was very bad, I started thinking that I might need to make a choice. I need to do some bargaining. So what I did, my dad was 6'4" and weighed about 230 pounds, and he was a very big man. He was very big in stature, and he was very big in voice. My mom was 5'2" and weighed about 100 pounds. And what I thought I needed to do was, because I knew that one of them had died from what my neighbor was telling me, this lady. And so what I thought I had to do was I needed to make a choice. And so I needed to start bargaining with God, and so I did. And I asked God that if one of them had to die, let it be my dad. Because I could get away with a lot more with my mom. My mom wasn't as strict as my dad. My mom didn't hit as hard as my dad. I made that choice, and about an hour later, they told me my dad had died. And for the next 25 years, I felt like I did that. I felt like that I was powerful enough to make a wish like that, and it would come true. And I remained that powerful for a very long time. When my dad did die, we didn't cry. We didn't grieve. My mom was in the hospital for quite a while. She couldn't come to the funeral. We buried my dad. One relative would tell my brother and I not to cry, to be strong. And another relative would, you know, yank us down their lap and tell us to cry. So we got a lot of mixed messages, and we never did grieve his death. We never talked about it. I remember the day that my mom came home from the hospital. We ran to greet her, and we were so excited to see her. And when she walked in the house, she started crying. We didn't understand why. We pretty much just shut down all of our feelings then. So we spent a lot of time being very good and very strong and very guilty. There was a tremendous amount of guilt that I never told my dad I loved him. It never occurred to me that he never told me he loved me either. But I've always felt so terribly guilty about that. After my dad's death when I was 12, I don't really remember a whole lot about the next several years in my teenage years, partly because I was a little wild when I was a teenager, and partly because I didn't spend much time in that time. When I was 13, I was planning what I was going to do when I was 16, and when I was 16, I was planning what I was going to do when I was 18, and when I was 18, I was waiting until I was 21. I was, you know, 21 to 25, and, you know, 30 was going to be the magic age, of course. But I was waiting to grow up. I was waiting until things came together. I was waiting until I thought that when I got to be a certain age, there'd be a magic age when everything would be okay, and I'd feel okay. I'd be okay inside. I wouldn't have to feel like I was walking around with a mask on all the time. I had lots of plans. I planned my life after little golden books, and on the last page it says, "And lived happily ever after." And that's what I thought it was supposed to be. I spent a lot of time watching Jimmy Stewart movies, and they all had happy endings. You know, all those old movies had great endings. I'd stay up all night and watch old movies and just cry, and then it'd be wonderful. That's how it's supposed to be. Leave It to Beaver, you know, June. I followed in June's footsteps, and a month after I got out of high school, when I was 17, I got married. I was already enrolled in nursing school, and I had been really looking forward to nursing school, except I knew that I would fail. I wouldn't be a good nurse. I wouldn't be any good. I'd probably kill somebody. And so what I did was I got married instead. And I married into a strict Catholic family. I was raised a Southern Baptist, and that stopped when I was 12, too. I quit my Baptist faith at 12 after my dad died because I was mad at God for killing him, even though I thought that I had done it, but I had to blame somebody else too. And also, when I was 12 at my church, they told me that I couldn't drink, smoke, or dance. And those were things that were in my plans, you know, shortly. You know, they're coming up. So I stopped going to church at that time too. And there was a lot of conflicting things, you know, as a kid. I wanted to be a nun when I grew up, and I was Southern Baptist. Yeah, but I watched The Nun Story, and it was a really heartwarming movie, and it ended really good. You know, I was really into good endings. And so I wanted to be a nun, I wanted to be an opera singer, I wanted to be all these, you know, things. But I married into the Catholic family, and was reminded daily that I was to be a good wife, and to be a good wife, that meant servience. And I did that. It amazes me today, you know, when I think back. And I got lots of aprons for wedding presents, little frilly aprons, if you can just imagine. So I had lots of aprons. I got up every morning. I poured the milk on my husband's cereal. That was his breakfast of choice. And first I poured the milk into a crystal pitcher, though. I'm relatively sure that this was on Leave It to Beaver and all those movies that I used to watch. But I'd pour the milk into the crystal pitcher, and then I would sit down and pour the milk on his cereal. and then I would sit and watch him eat. And I don't remember ever having a bowl of cereal with him. But I just took, like, I took just joy in watching him eat. He came home every day at 11 o'clock and had two sandwiches cut horizontally with mayonnaise on both sides. And I made those for him, and I sat there and I watched him eat. I don't remember having a meal with this man. But I wasn't allowed to smoke, and I did smoke, and so I smoked out the windows when he was gone. I snuck outside. I used lots of mouthwash and stuff like that. And there were men's jobs and there were women's jobs in our household. Women, you know, women cooked, men took out the trash, and they barbecued. And the greatest story that I remember, this, you know, is worth the 3.5 years just to watch him burn down the hibachi that day. We were married in 1972. He was 25 and I was 17. I always liked older men. Later on, I preferred them married. And the very first fight that we had, we'd been married for a week. We moved into our little house in Blytheville, Arkansas. And I should have known then. So we moved into this house, and we had our very first fight. And I sat on the front porch that night and cried and told him I wanted a divorce. You weren't supposed to fight. I saw my parents fight one time in the 12 years that I was home with my mom and dad. And my dad woke me up in the middle of the night that night and apologized. He was drunk. And they didn't fight in those movies, and they didn't fight in those golden books. And that's the only thing that I had to go on. You know, that was real life to me. That was the way it was supposed to be, and that's not the way my life was going. As it was, we didn't get a divorce. But alcohol and drugs became a very big part of our life. He was in the service, and he went overseas quite a lot. And this is during the Vietnam War, and Thai weed is what I remember of it. But it was of the 3.5 years we were married, he was overseas about 2 years of that. And we didn't know each other. I mean, I don't know that we knew each other when we got married, but it was a way out for me. You know, I got out. I got into something that I thought would be good. But I wasn't a brave person. And the way that I had always gotten out of relationships that I didn't want to be in anymore was I had affairs. I could never leave a relationship without having another relationship. You know, it was that way in high school. It was that way then. So what I did to get out of this marriage was I had an affair. And this was someone that told me that I was wonderful, thought that I was really special, and gave me an insurmountable amount of attention that I wasn't getting. Right at that time, my husband was more into drinking and drugs than he was into me, and I needed someone to be into me. In the early 70s, we got transferred to Wichita, and I didn't want to move. I didn't want to stay married, but I was very afraid of getting out of the marriage. And then he found out that I was having an affair. And, of course, then I was very guilty. Then I was the bad person. And I felt like I was. So what I did was I wished this man out of my life. He had a lot of drug problems himself. I wished that he was dead. I moved to Wichita with my husband, and we got things together. And this man in my life put a gun to his head and blew his brains out. And I thought I was responsible. And again, I thought that I did that. I thought that I was powerful enough to be able to do that I could wish people dead. And it kept me guilty all the time. I always felt so guilty. I was always looking, whatever relationship I was in, I was always looking around. You know, I was always looking for greener grass. No matter who I was with, I was always looking over their shoulder, seeing if there was somebody over there better or somebody that would make me happy. The thing that I have learned in this program is the grass is greener where it's watered. You know, I never watered the grass back then. And you know, that's one of the gifts this program has given me. I moved, I was living in Wichita then in 1974. That's when I moved to town. And from 1974 until about 1979, I was out shopping for alcoholics. And I found a good part of them in Wichita. Went through a lot of relationships. No wasn't in my vocabulary at that time. I was out to find somebody to love me. I was out to find somebody to hold me. And the cost of that at some times was very high, but it was worth it at the time. To be in this program today and to have hugs be such a part of that, you know, because this, you know, hugs is what I've been looking for all my life. You know, since I was a little kid, all I ever wanted was someone to hold me. You know, and I can come to an AA or an Al-Anon function and get all the hugs I need. You know, I hug the way that I want to be hugged. So if you've got a bad back or something, you know, you need to tell me ahead of time. Yeah. In 1979, I met the man who's my husband today. We worked together. I had a boyfriend. He had a wife. And you'll be surprised to know that I did not have an affair with him. I was. I tried. But what Keith and I were best friends. We were drinking buddies. I had a very high tolerance for alcohol. He had a very low tolerance for alcohol. We drank a lot together. We partied a lot. We told each other all of our problems. And we were great friends. In about 1980, he went to treatment. And his marriage dissolved. I was still with this other alcoholic. And he moved to Texas. He left the wife and kids, got a divorce, and moved to Texas for a while. And I continued my affair and with this other married guy and started, you know, doing the same things that I'd always done. You know, I was looking for him, and, you know, it was just a really horrible situation. And in the early 80s, I think in 81, Keith called me one day and said he was moving back to Wichita, or he was coming back to Wichita to visit. And so he came for the weekend, and he stayed for the weekend. We went to dinner, and then he spent the weekend with me. And then he went back to Texas. About the next Monday, he called me and said that he was moving back to Wichita. And this was not what I had in my plans. You know, the weekend was okay. You know, all the time wasn't. But he did. And he came back. He left a regular guy, and he came back a cowboy. Funny how things change. And he moved right in with me, and I don't really remember how that happened. It just did. You know, he started out with 2 inches in the closet, and then it went to 4 inches, and then, you know, he'd move my clothes down this far, and I'd move them back this far. I gave him a drawer. I was in total control of our relationship because he did have a little tendency to take off for a few days at a time. And but I knew in my relationship with Keith, I knew that I was in trouble. I was going to my mom's one weekend to visit, and I had bought me some cowboy boots, and I had gotten a cowboy hat. And then I turned the radio on to KFDI. And that was, I knew right then, you know, that was the beginning. I was becoming what I thought he wanted me to be. He was a cowboy, so certainly he must want a cowgirl. I did that all my life. You know, I didn't see that until I got into Al-Anon. But you know, if I dated a guy that liked to go hunting, I went to the shooting range to learn how to shoot, and I'd, you know, carry the backpack or whatever, you know, I'd carry the stuff for the birds or whatever. If I, you know, was dating a guy that worked on cars, I'd change the oil and clean carburetors and, you know, read Road and Track and all that kind of stuff. You know, I could be whatever you wanted me to be. You know, I was a chameleon. I can still do that today. So it's something that I really have to watch, to stand here and be Cheryl. Because sometimes that's really hard to stand here and be Cheryl instead of thinking, you know, well, I wonder what they want. You know, you want me to be Cheryl. I didn't have any opinion of myself. You know, my opinion of me was your opinion of me. You know, whatever you thought of me is what I thought of me. If you thought I was a bitch, I was a bitch. And if you thought that I was a great gal, then I was a great gal. I was like a sponge. You know, it was very hard for me to find out who I was, you know, who my higher power wanted me to be. After about 3 years of Keith living with me in my apartment, where I paid the bills, I got tired of Keith drinking. And we did drink together, but my drinking had lightened up a lot because it was difficult to watch him drink anymore, and that became my job. I remember one time we were at the Scotch and Sirloin in Wichita, and we were with a business associate of his, and he just got plowed. And I was so embarrassed. You know, I was just so embarrassed. And he got up. Well, in fact, he dropped a $100 bill on the floor. And I remember picking that $100 bill up and put it in my purse. You think to keep it. That's what I do today. But what I did was I took that $100 bill and I put it in my purse. And the next morning, I showed him what he did. You know, you dropped a $100 bill. You know, you would have lost it if I hadn't have found it. Today it had been spent. But I had to show him, you know, I always wanted to, had to show him what he had done. You know, that night, we were getting up to leave, and he fell down, and he fell across the table of people that were having dinner. So he's laying there across these people's table, and this man at the table says to me, you know, let me help you. We'll take him out back and put him in the dumpster. And I just went off on this man, you need to mind your own business, and defending, the nature of the disease. I told him to mind his own business, and little did I know that years later I'd be minding my own. I spent a lot of time marking bottles. We kept the whiskey in the refrigerator, and I'd take a wax pen, and I'd mark the bottle of Chevis where it was at. And I'd go to work. Sometimes Keith worked, sometimes he didn't. When I come home from work that night, the first thing I do is go to the refrigerator and hold the bottle up. And always that wax pen mark was up here, and the whiskey was down here. And every single time that ever happened, I would say, God, Cheryl, you can't even mark a bottle right. You know, not one time in all the times I did that, did I say, he's drinking. It was always me. I always blamed me. You know, if I was just better, if I was prettier, if I was thinner, if I was taller, if I was shorter, if I was anything, if I was more interesting, then he'd love me enough and he'd stop. You know, but I took it, you know, his drinking I took very personally. It was me. It was always me. If I could just make him happy, then he wouldn't do this anymore. It was always me. In 1984, he decided to go to treatment. Again, the first treatment center, he had stayed sober for about 2 hours. So we went to Valley Hope, and I was so proud of him. You know, I was so happy. In the treatment center at Valley Hope, I made a decision that I would stop drinking. He says that one of us got sober at that treatment center. So I quit drinking when he was in treatment. And I did that for a couple of reasons. The primary one was to show him how easy it was. You know, it was, I did it under the feign of supporting him. But really I wanted to show him how easy it was. You know, you just don't drink. It's, you know, just like that. I was very afraid to go with him. They invited me to stay for a week at the treatment center, and I told them that I couldn't. I was too busy. I was working a full-time job, and I just didn't have time. I was too busy. In fact, I hadn't had a vacation in 7 years. I'd never taken any time off. I worked every moment that I could. I was so afraid to go to that treatment center because I was so afraid that they would know. You know, that if I spent too much time around those people, that they would know. They'd know it was my fault. You know, I just knew that they would tell me that he wouldn't do the things he did if it wasn't for you. And so I didn't go. I had a lot of support from my in-laws, my mother-in-law, who was constantly telling me how good I was for him. You're so good for him. You're just so good for him. I only worry about him when you're not with him. He was my job. You know, it was my job to make sure that he got up and go to work. It was my job to make sure that he dressed appropriately, that he made it to the dentist office. This past year, I saw in my book that he had a dentist appointment, and I reminded him of it the day before. And then the next day came, and I looked and I thought, well, do I call him and tell him? I thought, no, He's 40 years old now. No one calls and reminds me of my doctor's appointments. So I didn't call him. And I was relatively sure that he would miss the appointment. His teeth would fall out or something. He called me a little bit later, and he said, "Oh, shit, Cheryl, I forgot my dentist appointment." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I called and made another one." You know, all those years, I'd be so angry at him, you know, when he'd miss an appointment. You know, I just scold him, and you know, scolding like a child, you know, that he missed his appointment. I never had to do that, you know, but I felt like it was my job. When he was in treatment, I also thought that I needed to find him a sponsor when he got out. I knew that was one of the things you're supposed to do. So I went to every AA meeting that he went to. I went with him in support to make sure that he went. And so I went, and I said, "My name's Cheryl, and I pass. I'm with him." And then after the meeting, I'd be listening, you know, during the meeting for who would make a good sponsor for him. And I found a guy one night, and so Keith asked him, and the guy told him no. And I hated that man. After he had gotten out of treatment, Valley Hope had an anniversary kind of party about a month afterwards, and we went to that. And I was really concerned. I was very concerned about Keith getting a sponsor, of course, I didn't have a sponsor. Of course, I didn't go to meetings either. And he didn't want me to. You know, he was very supportive of me not going to Al-Anon. And so that's what I want that support. So we went to this deal, and I saw his counselor that was in treatment, his counselor at Valley Hope, and I made a beeline to him. And he was a very large man, and I ran up to him, and he kind of picked me up, you know, into the air, and I whispered into Bear's ear, "Ask Keith if he's got a sponsor yet." And he lovingly set me on the floor and said, "I can't do that, Cheryl, but do you?" And I hated him. And he knew. You know, I felt like in my heart that he knew it was me, that it was me again. I did go to one Al-Anon meeting at that time, and I walked in, and they were laughing. They were, like, clear at that other wall down there, and they were laughing, and they were hugging, and I knew that they wouldn't understand. You know, they didn't know what I was going through, and so I sat there through the meeting, and then I slipped out as fast as I could. In a very short time of Keith getting out of treatment, he was drinking and using again, but he wasn't doing that at home anymore. When I had a chance to go to San Francisco with my mom for a vacation, and was told several times by many people that they knew what would happen if I left. Keith would get drunk. I said, "Oh, no, he won't. He's going to meetings. He'll be fine." See, I had quit going to meetings with him. And I went to San Francisco, and the same day he had already gotten the whiskey and hid it in the shower, and I didn't know about that for quite a while. But Keith got drunk, and he was drunk that whole week that I was gone, and he was drunk for the next 18 months. And I felt like it was my fault. You know, if I hadn't have gone, he wouldn't have gotten drunk. I asked him at this Al-Anon meeting that I went to, how could I make him stop? I wanted the Book of Answers. I was looking through the books after, and she said, "There's no Book of Answers, but there's this book, you know, take it." And I said, "No." You know, I wanted to know how to make him stop. At this point, it was in early 1986 was probably one of the very lowest points in my life. I wanted to die. I wanted him to die. I didn't really care which one of us died. I had kind of always had that, you know, that death wish inside anyway. You know, life was very painful. Life was very hard. I heard recently that dying's easy, but it takes courage to live, and I believe that. Keith had been, he had left on a binge, and he had been gone for several days. I didn't look this time. I didn't look for him. What I did was, on a Sunday night, I went into the bathroom mirror, and I was crying, because I always cried in front of the mirror to see how I looked. You don't want to look too bad by yourself. And so I was in front of the mirror, and I was crying, and I've done that all my life. It was pitiful. But I said into the mirror, that, you know, I asked God, and I hadn't prayed for a very, very long time, but I asked God that if Keith would never be happy, if he would never find hope in his life, never have love in his life, then to please take him. So I knew that he was miserable. You know, I knew he was. But I just didn't want to worry about it anymore. What I did that night and didn't realize it was I let go of him. And the next morning he came home. And I was mad as hell. I was so mad. I was one who punished with silence. I used to keep bells on the front door, I slept on the couch so he'd wake me up when he was out. And when he would come in the door, the bells would go off and they'd wake me up and then I would ignore him. I wasn't someone who... I never yelled, you know. I never yelled my whole life. I don't recall, other than being by myself in front of the mirror, ever showing anger. Never showed any anger. Never showed any feelings at all. But he came back and he wanted to go into treatment again. And so I didn't take him. I was an ice cube. I was cold. I didn't feel anything anymore. But a friend came over and took him to RSC, which is Recovery Services in Wichita. And it's an indigent treatment center, which on welfare, and you get treatment. And that's where he found sobriety. And he hated it. Oh, he hated it. I used to buy us these cheap cigarettes, and he'd take his Marlboro carton, the little hard pack, and fill it up with my cheap cigarettes. He wouldn't let anybody know, you know, that he was smoking those. And, of course, I, you know, told everyone that I had to smoke cheap cigarettes because we only had my money and he wasn't working and all this poor me stuff. But they told me at the treatment center what I had to do was, in order to see him, was to go to Al-Anon. And actually, at that point, I really didn't care if I saw him or not. But I couldn't, that was kind of a nasty thing. You know, that wasn't being nice, and I was very nice. And so, of course, I told him that I would, and I couldn't hurt his feelings by telling him I didn't want to see him. So I went to a Al-Anon meeting there at the treatment center, and no one else came except for one lady, and she told me it only took two people to have a meeting. And so she sat there, and she shared her story with me, and she answered questions for me. Then she gave me her name and her phone number, and I wrote on that card that she had been in Al-Anon for 17 years at that time, which I thought was just ungodly. And so as I was cleaning my file box out about 5 years ago, I came across that card. And her name was Margaret McGill, and that's my friend here that's with me today. And Margaret and I had been great friends for those 5 years before I realized that was her at my very first Al-Anon meeting. And so she remains very special to me. She told me where there was Al-Anon meetings close to my house, and I started attending them. They told me crazy things at this meeting. What I wanted to do was I wanted to decide, you know, that night when to leave him, how to leave him, you know, those kind of things. And I needed to make decisions, what I was going to do. And these people in this meeting told me that I didn't have to decide. They told me that I could decide not to decide. I could decide not to decide for 2 weeks. And then when that 2 weeks came, I could decide to decide in two more weeks. And I thought that was really stupid. Today I know it saved my life, and I believe that it saved, you know, or saved our relationship. They told me that I could do things one day at a time, that I could just live through one day. Most important, they told me it wasn't my fault. They told me that he didn't drink because of me. And that's what I needed to hear. For all of those years, it's what I needed to hear. I needed someone to tell me that it wasn't my fault. After I spent a little time talking to a counselor, and about 30 days into his treatment, I was able to call. He called me at home, and because I hadn't decided if I was going to let him come home or not. But he called me, and I said, just shut up. I never tell people to shut up. I'm nice. And yeah, I tell them to shut up a lot today in fun. But I said, just shut up. Don't say anything. And he said, Cheryl, what is it? And I said, I love you. Just don't say anything else. Don't ruin it. I love you, okay? And he said, okay. And I hung up. And that was the beginning of us rebuilding our life together. That was the beginning of me looking at me, of me finding out that there's stuff wrong with me too. You know, there's character defects that I have that aren't easy to live with. I was able to start changing the focus. Instead of looking at him, I could look at me. I didn't know that. I thought it was my job to look at him. I thought it was my job to direct everything that was going on. I did spend time at those first meetings not talking. I cried a lot. I sat a lot. Once in a while, I'd get one question out. What I did most of all was I wouldn't hang around afterwards and talk. What I would do is I'd put my head down and I'd head out the front door and I'd sit in my car and cry because no one talked to me. It was real hard to let people know me. And I know today that that's because I didn't know me. You know, I didn't think you'd like me if you did. You know, I wasn't going to take the chance of the rejection. One of the most important things that I've learned to say to the alcoholic in my life, and recently I've learned to everyone else in my life, is I don't know. When Keith was out of treatment, especially that first year, he'd asked me a question, and I'm the kind of person that would just love to tell you. You know, I'd love to tell you. Love to have that answer. And so if I had to lie, he'd say, you know, how do you spell something? And I didn't know how to spell it. So I'd say, huh? Just a minute. And I'd head off to the dictionary, look up the word, and then I'd come back in, and he'd ask me again, not telling him how to spell it. You know, alcoholics are not the only people that have big egos. But when I learned to say I don't know, what he did was he started calling his sponsor. You know, when Cheryl, you know, quit having the answers for him and for anybody else, they began talking to people that did know. So that's today. It's very important to me. I was attending one meeting a week on a Friday night. And Keith was attending at least 7 meetings a week. He was going to meetings every day. He had friends. He didn't need me anymore. I felt very left out after all I had done for him. So I shared that at a meeting one night. And a girl there referred me to a tape of a woman named Sue from California that I think has been here before. And in this tape, this person said that if you go to one meeting a week, you're keeping a seat warm for a newcomer. If you go to 2 meetings a week, you can maintain. If you go to 3 or more meetings a week, you can grow. And from that moment on, from the moment I heard those words on that tape, because that was me, you know, I didn't want to keep a seat warm anymore. I didn't want to just maintain anymore. I wanted to grow. I had to grow, or we wouldn't be together anymore. I was so afraid then of all that, you know, all the time of being together and going through what we did, of losing him. I'm going to lose him in sobriety because I'm not taking care of me. So that's what I did. I began to let people know me, and I began looking for a higher power. I spent a lot of time using yours, stealing yours. I heard Father Leo one time shared at a conference in Wichita that if you didn't have a God, to think of God as good orderly direction, you know, doing the right thing. And that's what I tried to do. I wish I could stand here and tell you that I remember the moment that God came into my life and when I could feel, you know, a presence with me all the time, and I can't. I know it was very gradual, and I know it was really wonderful. But my higher power is with me all the time. And I really appreciate, you know, when I go to talk someplace that they've got clean bathrooms so I can get on my knees before I come out here. It's important. I didn't get a sponsor for quite some time. I'm not proud of that. I think I'd probably be a little farther along than I am today if I had it. But I knew who I wanted to ask, but it was very hard to reach out. When I finally got the courage to do that, and it was a woman who used to sit across the room from me, and she would say, when I didn't share, stay silent, stay sick, stay silent, stay sick. And I really didn't like that, but I knew that that was the person that I needed. So after the meeting one day, I went up to her, and I said, I really need to get a sponsor. And I waited for her to ask me. And she said, yeah, it helps. It's real helpful. And I thought, well, she must have not really understood quite what I was saying. And I said, no, I really need to get a sponsor. And she said, yeah, Cheryl, it helps. And then I knew that she wasn't going to, you know, ask me to let her be, you know, my sponsor. And I said, would you be my sponsor? And she said, I'd love to. And she gave me a hug, really good hug. And I said, okay, what do I do? And I'm, you know, in the general mode. And she said, you call me. And I said, okay, what do I say? And she said, why don't you just say hi? That hadn't occurred to me. I thought I had to call and have a reason. I thought I had to have something. I still to this day call her and say hi. And the words come. The words follow. I have two stepchildren. They were 5 and 9 when Keith and I got together. They're 22 and almost 18 today. And when we were 5 years into sobriety in our home, the oldest one became a traitor from this house of sobriety. And he started to drink and use drugs and steal. And I was so angry with him. Because here we had given him, you know, a home and love and sobriety in our house. And how dare he rain on my parade. Life was very easy right then. And he made it hard. And I resented him greatly. What I found out was that I had to start over. You know, I'd love to stand here and say, and I, you know, did all the right things, you know. But I didn't. And I didn't react well to his behavior. I reacted, you know, much in the same way that I reacted early, you know, when my husband was drinking. But what I had to do is I had to go back to the basics of this program. I had to go back to the steps, and I had to become powerless over Jason. He did go to treatment within a fairly short amount of time, and he has 4 years of sobriety today. He doesn't go to as many meetings as I think he should go to. I don't know that he has a sponsor. I cringe a little bit when he says he has 4 years of sobriety. I want to say he has been dry for 4 years. But that's not my business. And I learned this lesson from a cat. I'll tell you that in a minute. A couple years ago, about a year ago, my youngest stepson came home late one night, and there was lots of cars out front and lots of noise, and I got up, and Justin came in the house, and he was drunk. He was just plowed, just sloppy, vomit-ridden drunk. And I was sick. I was so sick. He took his anger out on me. And when it was over and we decided that what were we doing, talking to a drunk child, you know, it's not any different than talking to a drunk adult. You don't talk. It's not the time to talk. We'll talk tomorrow. I went to the bedroom, and I sat on the bed, and the first thing that came to my mind was, if I had just spent more time with him, if I had just been a better mother. And it doesn't have anything to do with me. It doesn't have anything to do with me. I don't know that he's an alcoholic. You know, he's actually more like me than he's like his dad. But it was amazing to me for me to see how quick I can go back, you know, to wanting to taking the blame, you know, instead of, you know, remembering that it's a disease. But back to this cat. Being a stepmother, there's I found fine lines in things that you can do or not do. I've had a real hard time in letting go of kids because I think that you're supposed to show kids and do and teach and direct, and like my folks did. I don't know if they did or not. But I have this cat, and her name's Charlie, and she's 4.5 years old. And she came from the outside. Justin brought her home, and she never wanted to be inside. But I only have inside cats. My cats can't go outside because they might get run over and they might die. And I don't let go of anything. So I made Charlie stay inside, and she was a very unhappy cat. She never purred. As she got older, she got worse. She started wetting in the house, and I just can't tolerate that. And she started biting me. Every time she'd slip out of the house, I'd spank her. You don't spank cats. You spank dogs, I guess, but you don't spank cats. So what Charlie started doing was Charlie started biting me whenever I'd spank her. That didn't teach me anything. But she was miserable. You know, she didn't have a life. She spent all of her time looking out the doors and looking out the windows and being unhappy. With her behavior problems, we decided that what we had to do was we had to let Charlie go outside. And so what I had to do was I had to put Charlie in God's hands. And I've been putting people in God's hands for quite a while now, and I have to do that with this cat, too. So I let her go out, and she's been going out for almost a year now. And this cat's motor never turns off. She comes in at when it starts to get dark every night. She comes in and sleeps with us. But she's so happy, you know. It's just incredible listening to her and holding her, and she just lets me hold her and love her. And she, you know, she never did that before. She wouldn't let you love her. She acted like she didn't like it. You couldn't pet her. She'd, you know, get way down so you couldn't touch her. And now she just loves to be, you know, touched all over. What I do every day was when I take her to the door to let her out, was I pick her up and I hold her in my arms, and I tell her I love her, and I tell her to be careful. And then I ask God to take care of her. And then I realized that that's the same thing that I got to do with these kids. That's all I got to do. That's all there is at this point for me to be a mom to Justin and Jason, is holding them, tell them I love them, and ask God to take care of them. That's my job. And I can't tell you the difference in our relationship today. And that's all I do. You know, it's amazing. It works. I have a great aunt who died in the late 60s, and her husband drank. You don't have to drink to die from alcoholism. And my grandmother keeps a notebook of obituaries, like most of us keep photo albums of our family members. And I saw my aunt's obituary, and it said that it was an accidental shooting. And in this accidental shooting, they found her laying by the front door in the doorway with her head on a pillow, a note in her hand, and a gun to her head. And she killed herself. And that was an accidental shooting back then. I have a great-great-grandfather who they found in the field with his wrist and his throat slashed, and the knife in his hand. And that was an accidental death. You know, when I try and find out my family history, that's the answers I get. And I always say, Granny, did they drink? Did he drink? I don't think so, honey. I spent a lot of time in my life trying to get people to love me. And what I learned in this program is that I have to tell you that I love you. That's my job. I spent a lot of tortured time in my life wanting my dad to hear my dad's words that he loved me. You know, my grandpa that I thought was mean, I wanted to know that he loved me. When my granddad was in the hospital and he was dying, and I had never told him that I loved him. I'd been in the program for several years. But I went into his room and we visited and we talked, and it was good. I stood at the top of his bed, and I said, I love you, Grandpa, because I can say those words today. And everyone in my family hears those words today. And it doesn't matter if they can say them or not. But when I told my grandpa that I loved him, he reached up and he pulled me down on top of him, down to his chest, and he held me there. And he didn't say, I love you, Sherry, because he didn't know how. My dad didn't know how. Because no one taught him. You all taught me, and I'll love you forever for that. Thank you.